going to go ahead and call our Monday, June 2nd pre-council to order. As a reminder, to make the audio better, we are using microphones, so we'll share. And we have one topic on tonight's agenda, and it is the material recovery facilities discussion. So I'm going to kick it over to almost official director, Aaron Keats.
Good evening. Aaron Keats, Utilities Director. Tonight we're talking about options for the solid waste material recovery facility and recycling and some solid waste topics. So we have Kate Vasquez here from RRT to give a presentation on their report on the additional analysis for MRF options. And just following that, I was going to discuss some other solid waste and MRF topics, update on the MRF, the community desire for our recycling program, our some solid waste finances, a proposal for automated recycling collection, and then seeking some council direction. So just keep that in mind. So I think Kate's presentation is a different one, so we'll get that.
There's me.
There we go. And I'll turn it over to Kate.
All right. Well, thank you, Aaron. Thanks, everyone. It's really great to be back here in Columbia to talk with you guys again, to give an update on some of the analysis regarding recycling processing here in Columbia, both continuing the work of the project that was ongoing and then also in the wake of the storm from April 20th. I just wanted to give you a quick layout of the contents of the slides. Excuse me. We're going to look at just a reminder of what the project has done in the past few years that we've been working on it, what we know of the current program status as it has changed since the report was written. We'll revisit the three options for rebuilding in MRF as they were generated before the storm and as what has changed with the involuntary demolition of the existing MRF. And we will revisit the discussion of a transfer option and then look briefly at the concept of a new kind of drop-off center. We're using multi-material environmental center right now because it would not only be recycling drop-off in this concept, it would be some other materials, so we'll talk about that. And then we have some revised very high-level timelines to talk about, but there are some drivers that are unknowable right now, but they are expected to affect the timeline as it was originally projected. So briefly, I'm not going to read all this to you, but basically when we last met, there were three urgent issues that are now resolved or they're moot discussions. At that time, curbside recycling had been suspended. Would go in and out for staffing reasons that we don't understand. The recycling drop-off centers were considered in real dire shape. They were contributing greatly to contamination at the recycling center at the MRF, and they were diverting a lot of staff time to handle that dumping situation where things that then people couldn't cram into the recycling containers, they would. And then the third was our concerns with the MRF itself. It was not operating as designed, so it was operating inefficiently. And then it had a lot of other issues that we're all familiar with from the previous reports that are moot now because it's, you know, it's out of operation. Now we are facing the need to restart processing of the collected recyclables, the need to reopen a drop-off facility to be determined, and the need to renew and improve programs as discussed throughout this project. The current status that we're looking at, previously our project had found that there was a lot of interest and participation was pretty good at Columbia. There could be more volume, but people who were participating were doing a good job as far as avoiding contamination. And the set out rate, which is a little different than participation, but what I observed at the curb was slightly low, but not bad. So it was good, and what people were putting was good. So I would take that as a good, strong interest in recycling. I think that's what that reflects. There was a lot of trouble at the drop-off centers, as I said, and we had identified as a high priority cardboard that was coming out of the business sector and being disposed of as trash instead of recycled as a commodity. And the biggest opportunities we were looking at were improving programs, including participation and quality, in order to increase diversion and recycling. In our current conditions, from what I have observed from a distance, there is still a lot of active interest in recycling in Columbia. That's also what I hear from staff. The drop-off centers are at this moment closed, we all know that. And we have a priority of getting processing of recyclables back and some drop-off, quality drop-off for people when they have excess material or they have something, they have a lot of equipment or they miss their set-out date, something like that. We still have a big opportunity to reduce contamination and optimize services. So this is a graph that was from the original report. This is from the waste composition study that the city commissioned and RRT had a specialized vendor conduct. This is a very high level explanation of the material that is delivered to the landfill during the survey period. 21% of it was material that the discard person could have put into a recycling program. So this is our very typical bottles and cans and cardboard. I do want to clarify, it does not include, for example, every single piece of plastic, because every single piece of plastic can't go into a recycling program. And that would be what was over in the 41% for disposal, so like toothpaste caps and things like that. They were subject to the study. I just wanted to clarify that 21% is items that could have been put into recycling. The 38% of other recyclables are materials that an individual in existing programs in Columbia could have diverted from disposal, but they did not. Plastic grocery bags, food scraps, clothing, textiles, these are all things for which there are outlets other than the garbage can, but that didn't happen. These were identified as more opportunities to support community-based programs, not necessarily that the city would get into the business of taking textiles or organics or something like that. But they can be diverted from disposal with individual effort. This chart is also from the original report. And this is the top 10 items that were in the waste characterization study, i.e. material that was delivered to the landfill. And a lot of these are trash, as I said, like you see there's remainder or composite organics, dirty paper, mixed recycled paper, things that do belong in the trash. But right here is, again, just pointing out there is a lot of cardboard being delivered to the landfill as waste, even before any of the current circumstances. And 10 to 1, it's from the business sector, not residential. So that's, I'm just underscoring the importance of not losing sight of that, because it is a big opportunity to recycle and divert more material, and cardboard is a really valuable commodity. Excuse me. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of recap for everyone the three scenarios that we continued to analyze for rebuilding MRF. This is going to tie together both the analysis from before the storm and then some commentary since. As a reminder, our first report included several other options, which we were directed to not pursue any further. One was to stop processing locally, for example, and begin transferring out of town. That was, I'll talk about that in a minute, but that was set aside early in the process. Some information has changed. But I want to look at the three for which we did conceptual designs, just to make sure everyone is familiar with them. So there were three, and they basically all involve building a new MRF at the landfill campus. Scenario A is to build on the existing site. The initial analysis included the interest in salvaging what might be possible of the building, not the equipment, but the actual structure, most of which is gone now. But that was the idea, is that it would be the same footprint. There's already concrete and pavement and other infrastructure already in place, so there would be some savings. Scenario B was to build a whole new MRF on what's currently the landfill operations site, directly across the driveway from the admin building. And then the third was to build a whole new MRF on the gravel lot that's due west of the admin building. I can show you some drawings here real briefly. This to orient you, the area, this is the aerial. That's the current MRF site that you see a design on. North is up. And if Aaron, if you would please, that's the admin building, just to orient everyone. So the idea here was to reuse a lot of the existing traffic flow and the pad that the building was on and a lot of pavement that could be built, reused or rebuilt or repurposed. When we made this design, we were constrained that we couldn't have traffic go through. So I did just want to show that if the scale house was moved, the traffic could move also. Because one of our concerns with this design was we didn't love a bunch more truck traffic going in front of the admin building. This is a minor update, but I did want to make the point that that can now be modified.
Can you point out where the scale is on that?
So there were some plans and drawings done several years ago to relocate the scale to the site that's there near the, right there. You can't really see it very well, but it does say relocated scale location just above those red and blue arrows.
Oh, right there.
Right.
And where is
currently
it?
Currently it's due north of that.
Currently it's right
there.
That's
the scale now.
Because the future landfill is down here, so that's why they were looking at moving the scale house.
We were trying to be mindful of that.
Where is the new one?
The new one's going to be down.
Landfill cell or scale?
The new landfill cell is going to be down here.
I'm sorry, I can't see down here where.
South of the admin.
You see where the red dot is?
Okay.
It's not on the diagram, so
okay. It's
over here.
All
Our
right,
existing
thanks.
Landfill is up here in this upper corner.
So the advantage of changing the direction for traffic would be that you just avoid traffic past the admin building.
Right.
And that.
I'm going to ask you to use the microphone.
Microphone.
Oh. Sorry.
You complain about it not being loud enough.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay.
I'm one of those that complain.
Yeah.
So the advantage of moving the traffic is primarily to avoid going past the admin building. Are there
Correct. Other
things that are helpful there?
Correct. So having more truck traffic come through here, as you see these lines, is not desirable. And this route, we anticipated, even if the scale didn't move, this route now is congested with the new the next landfill cell. But we now know, since we did this drawing, and I didn't redo the drawing for expediency, it could go through here. We now know. That was new information since we made the drawing. So I just wanted to clarify that in the report, you'll see it say one of the drawbacks of scenario A is having to put traffic through the admin building. And that's no longer the case.
I gotcha.
I should have left it that. So that I just wanted to make that point because it's one of the major objections to scenario A in our analysis that's no longer involved. Do you want to go to the next one? So this was scenario B, This was scenario B, which is to build on the current landfill operations center site. So there's the old MRF, there's the admin building. And this design, this is also different than you saw in the first report if you looked at that, because again, we had that site constraint for this location removed. The same one that was constraining the traffic from the design we were just looking at now allows this design to be more flexible. It was really constrained before. One of the best parts about this design is it keeps, you see, all its traffic is contained to itself. It doesn't have to intersect with anything else. And it would keep all this, this is all still unencumbered if it's not a MRF anymore. And then scenario C, which we don't have a lot of optimism about, but this is land that's there. That's the gravel lot that's due west of the admin building. It used to be a compost pad. There's a lot of unknowns. And again, same thing with the new landfill cell is going to be down here. And you have to access it like this or like this. It's just not, there's better options. So these were the scenarios that we analyzed. They have, we presented in the first report, and then the city asked RRT to continue with more in-depth analysis of these three, including scoring and ranking them against one another. So we did that. So just to show you, this is how the table looked when it was in the report. And this reflects some of the changes. Obviously, almost everything with scenario A has changed. There's no building to salvage, and the issue of needing to transfer during construction is no longer an issue. Also, this site is now rivaled in size by scenario B with the site constraints loosened. So one of the pros of scenario A had been there's plenty of room. But now B has plenty of room also. A little bit about the future use benefit, which is mentioned throughout. Scenario B and Scenario C both offered the benefit of preserving the current MRF site for future use, perhaps for maintenance operations, and or redeveloping it as a drop-off center or something else. The benefit isn't exactly mutual because neither the LOC site nor the gravel lot are as flexible as the MRF site. So there's still that benefit for B and C of you've still got all that space where the old MRF was that you could do something else with in the future. It's very flexible, it's sizable. So this is just the change. Like I said, scenario A, almost everything changes. The big differences for B and C are there's not a building there anymore where the MRF used to be.
Kate, before you go on.
Yes.
Can I ask on that, so I understand it's an update from the chart that was originally put together, but this reads like there's no benefits, there, you know what I mean, there's no longer risk, there's no limitations. Was it that RRT didn't have, because you had already completed the reports, didn't do any of those benefit risk analysis for the reuse of the existing site?
I have on another slide the risk-benefit ranking analysis that we did, and it has been updated. If you're asking about use of the site for the future?
No, for rebuilding, for that current site, for rebuilding a new MRF.
We will. I do have information about that, yes. Many of the risks are now, they're no longer in play. One of the biggest drawbacks of scenario A was having to shut down and transfer, and now they all involve transfer,
right?
Because it is shut down. So as far as comparing one to the other, that's irrelevant. Similarly, the equipment inside the building was going to cost the same no matter what where the building was, and so that wasn't something to rank between the three options. This is kind of summarizes what I just said, but to get at it real directly, is that the rebuilding on the existing MRF site at this time is now the most expedient in a time sense because there's very little that we need to do to get ready. There's nothing, you know, there's not much to demo. It's already been demoed. We're already shut down, and we don't have to move anything else. At the LOC site, we have to move some operations. At the gravel lot, I would imagine, we are assuming a large amount of geotechnical and site preparation. Scenario B offers the best integration with possible future capital plans related to opening the south landfill cell. And the cost estimate for scenario A is still marginally less than B and C, despite the loss of the building, partly because of all the pavement that already exists and the other infrastructure. These are the assumptions we used when doing the cost modeling. These are in the report also. The main, there's an assumption. One is very key here though. Our initial reading of the DNR rules is that both the transfer station and a MRF need a solid waste permit. And at this time, we know that there's a landfill permit. But some more research needs to be done about what that would involve. And that's time that we can't predict at this moment without additional working with the state and learning more about that. Other than that, most of these, they remain the same. They explained how we calculated owner's engineer fees and how costs of unnecessary demo aren't included, such as that. And finance and interest are not part of our cost estimate either. I wanted to share with you this diagram that explains what the buy is for the processing equipment. This was generously provided by an industry partner, CP, and they are one of the four major designers. This is not a recommendation or endorsement other than we know them to be a reputable company. They just provided this design as a courtesy, as an example of something that would meet the parameters for which we were seeking pricing, and then they gave us a number to use. You can see across the upper part of the design, this is still a dual stream system. The container line is the upper part of the diagram. I'll use my clicker here. The upper part here, it flows from left to right. I'll just point out a few of the elements. This is where bags, bottles and cans still come in bags, and the bags get broken, and the film goes to a compactor. The materials come through. The film is pulled out manually. The magnet sends the ferrous materials to a silo. And the blue colored pieces of equipment sort on five different kinds of plastics, which is an improvement from the previous system. Number one, PET bottles. Number two, HDPE natural, like a milk jug. Number two, HDPE color, like a Tide bottle. A 3-7 mix. And a number five, polypropylene, the best example is a sour cream tub. And then the ECS, which is an eddy current separator, sends out aluminum cans. And then residue, which is everything else, goes to a trash compactor. The bunkers and silos all feed balers to go out and be marketed as commodities. The fiber line, which is the lower part of the diagram, I typed this out so I could get it all. The lower part of the diagram, this has a metering drum which sorts by size so that the burden depth is good on continuing to process the different kinds of paper. The OCC screen, OCC is the abbreviation for corrugated containers. It kicks out the cardboard or material that acts like cardboard, looks or seems like cardboard to the screen. And then that gets quality checked by a person as, yes, this is cardboard, or no, this is not cardboard, and it goes back into the system to keep being sorted. The blue equipment sorts out, I'm going to point to it. Blue equipment sorts out the residue, sorts on fiber, and also on a different kind of fiber here, the chipboard, that's more like a cereal box. And the residue bunker, if it starts looking like it's got a lot of bottles and cans in it, it can send it back over to the other line to go through that line and get sorted also. This helps address the problem of if we're co-collecting in one cart bags of bottles and cans and loose cardboard and paper, if a bottle and can bag breaks, it can still make it to the recycling. It's not only a residue on the paper line.
And Nick and then Don.
Yeah. This has to do with the types of materials that we're going to recycle, because that changes from time to time. And like, I was disappointed to learn recently that we're not recycling clamshells. Well, a lot of things come in clamshells, unfortunately. So as that kind of thing changes in the market, mm-hmm. and the way that things are packaged, mm-hmm. because I think part of the problem with the clamshells is they're starting to use multiple plastics in those, so they can't be really separated. So what impact does that have on what we think of in terms of equipment?
That's a good question. So this system is designed to capture the most readily marketable materials. The clamshells that we're seeing these days, and probably for the last 10 years, you may have noticed like more and more of them, that lettuce comes in. For a while there were, you could often buy like a dozen apples in a kind of a clamshell, and it says number one PET on it, which is true, but the actual molecular makeup of that is not the same as a soda bottle. And the market wants the soda bottle. They want that chemistry. They want that exact material. Kind of like we say a belt and a shoe are both made out of leather, but they're not the same thing. And so the clamshells are an issue. We can engineer to recover anything, but what can we sell a bale of? If you wanted to have complex optical equipment that would capture clamshells, we can do that. They do that in some of the super MRFs, the places that have 75 and 90% recovery requirements, because they're trying to get every single thing out that they possibly can. But they're often sending those to be fuel, or there's some kind of other very low quality plastic. That is also in large port cities where they have more options. In this system, that would verge on over-engineering. And you would struggle to market a bale of that.
So we would essentially just separate out those that we're not going to be able to bale and not be concerned about. They would just immediately, I guess I'm asking, we will be able to do that,
right?
Separate that out and just put that into, I assume, the trash compactor at that point.
So see this one here where it says 3 to 7 bunker?
Mm-hmm.
That would be some of the materials you're talking about, even though 3 to 7s is the industry term, but it would also be some of those number one clamshells, for example. They can be sold as a very low-grade plastic material. There are some manufacturers that will use them to make very low-quality products. Think of if you buy seedlings at the nursery, and there's that really cheap black plastic that you only use it to get it home, and then it's garbage. They can make things like that out of that kind of plastic. It also can be a substitute high heating value fuel in industrial applications. I'm saying this all in a general sense. I don't know that that's available to Columbia, but this is what in other parts of the Midwest even can happen with those. So we can bale them as their own bale and see what happens, because they do have a market value. It's a penny a pound, sometimes a half a cent a pound, but they can move as a commodity instead of garbage.
Okay.
A product is more accurate. It's not really a commodity. Yes.
My question, cardboard, specifically your wax cardboard, like a milk carton, where does that go, or would that just get compacted landfill?
Those cartons are actually coated with another type of PET plastic. They aren't a wax anymore, which kind of makes them even, in some ways, easier, because the plastic can soak off. It hasn't permeated the paper the same way. Cartons are recyclable if there is a very specific buyer for them that does a lot of shredding to get to, it has to be much more highly processed before it can be used. I haven't researched if there's a good buyer for you for that. They are not difficult to sort out. In fact, they're often manually picked off at the end on the quality control, because they make it through all the other, they don't attract to a magnet, they don't go through the cardboard screen, they kind of end up at the end and they can get picked off readily.
Yeah, I mean, granted, when you go to the supermarket, you don't see much of that unless you're talking like your half and half or things like that. Most of the rest of your milk is in the plastic jugs now and other items, so thank you.
There's lots of other fluids and liquids that soups are increasingly sold.
Broths, more and more.
Okay.
And medical food. Medical food is sold in those Tetra Paks, also like little shakes that toddlers eat. And infants and other people with feeding tubes use medical food. Those are shelf stable, so they're sold in those packs. There's a lot of it.
A question back here.
Have a seat. I'll get your question in a second.
Okay.
You can keep going.
Okay. Is all right to move on from this diagram? Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a reprint of, I'm realizing now I can read this one. This is a reprint of the table that was in the report. And the strikeouts are items that have changed, largely due to the fact that the building is already demolished and that there's not much to recover there. So the costs are updated. I'd suggest not getting in the weeds about this, because these were high-level estimates that we replaced them with. Even they're not as deep dive as they were originally. So, for example, the cost to do interim processing, this is the best example, though. there was a line item here for interim processing that was only for scenario A because B and C assumed that the MRF would keep running while they were under construction. Well, that cost is for any of them now. And so we deleted that for the purposes of comparing. It shouldn't be there because it's not unique to scenario A. There was also some building costs that were different because we were gonna look to only have to do an expansion of that existing building. Now the costs are more consistent from option to option or scenario to scenario. So it's not that these necessarily went away, it's that they changed. We also, this processing equipment cost is lower because we don't have to demo as much of the old one. Site improvements went up, again, assuming damage from the tornado. I made it consistent between the square footage of the others. You can see it really, some goes up and some goes down, and then you take away the $5 million for the extra processing as far as comparing one to the other. And the bottom line doesn't change a lot, and I don't mean to be cavalier about $1 million, but this is a rough order magnitude estimate, so that's not an obvious decision-making point in the comparison of how much was A affected.
Can I ask, and this might be a question for Aaron or Tom, what is currently at the Landfill Operations Center, or have they all moved across to the admin building?
So with the So with the Landfill Operations Center, the staff that actually work on the landfill, a crew of about 20, three supervisors, the bioreactor specialist, all work out of that building. And in the rear of that building is the container maintenance. All the metal dumpsters and compactors that are placed throughout the city. They have hydraulics, they have electrical components, and they need a lot of welding on them to get some life out of them, and a lot of painting, and that's in the rear two bays.
So if we were to put a MRF on that current site, where does all of that operations go?
That would have to be moved somewhere.
So is that included in the cost estimate for scenario B for the building and site improvement?
It is not. No.
Would that be a consideration as it's part of the same utility?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think she had the demolition of the LOC included, but not a new LOC because
right.
Part of the thinking is when we expand the landfill horizontally, we may need to do a new LOC anyway. I don't know if that's...
It's in the capital improvement plan.
Yeah, it's in the plan to do one anyway. But if we wanted to expedite the MRF, you would have to do the LOC first, and so then that would even further delay doing a MRF.
Mm-hmm. That location.
My next topic to look at is to talk about revisiting the idea of no longer processing recyclables locally here in Columbia, and instead transferring them out of town.
Kate, before you move on, just
yes.
Really quick, on whatever site it was that had like the chain of command of the two different sites, the example processing equipment, to Nick's point about, you know, when the markets change, this is kind of the conversation we had with our old MRF, was that as, you know, when we started collecting plastics 3 through 7, how would we do it? Because we didn't have the flexibility. Is there anything in here that gives us more flexibility, or is this really just, this is what you collected before, here's how to recreate a system? And to also to Don's point about the Tetra Paks, like as that market of material quantity is growing, did you look into the market of selling it or any of those additional materials?
Our assignment hasn't included market research to date. It is something that we do. It wasn't included in the assignment so far. One of the limitations of the old MRF that was built in was there were only 5 bunkers on the container line. And that necessitated, for example, all of the HDPE plastic, the milk jugs and the Tide bottles, being sorted together as one product. Well, the natural, like the milk jug, is worth many times over as a commodity what the color one is. And if you mix them together, now they're all color. And so you were, not you personally, but that MRF was taking a high value commodity and mixing it in with a low value commodity, making them all low value commodity. That was a shortcoming of that design that was probably not foreseen at all, or it became, it was a casualty of adding in the number ones possibly. I don't know the exact history of how it got to be like that, but there were only five bunkers, so one was for HDPE, one was for PET bottles, one was for the, well, there were two for the grades of metals, and then one was trash. And part of what our analysis also found was while the four commodity bunkers were very, very good, there was lots and lots of material that was ending up in the trash bunker, again, as a function of the way that facility was designed. When it was designed, there weren't nearly as many material. It was a very different profile, which I think gets to your question, which is how can we avoid that problem in the future? In the interim, the design of MRFs has evolved to be more flexible by nature. So this, you can see, has a lot of components and modules. This is a key part, and this is a really important, this is one of our key things, is these need to be modules that can be updated and revised and adjusted instead of one whole thing that's all soldered together, and if we're going to change it, we got to change the whole thing. We frequently go into systems like this and change something or modify it to reflect what's actually coming in the front door, either to improve capture and recovery, reduce valuable materials going into the residue, or avoid residue going in with the commodities. So that is an iteration of MRF design and engineering that has evolved since the old MRF was designed, and a lot of its limitations have basically been invented out of being a problem. Yes.
And maybe you'll address this later. I'm assuming a large part of this is automated. So do you have an idea as to manning, staffing levels, up, down, no changes?
The designer of this system, by example, basically this has one person at the front end of each and one person at the end of each. Now, that's not four FTEs, as you all know. That's four positions. So it could be more employees than that, but that's the main need for operators of this. There's no one manually picking except for QC at the front end. So if some enormous pieces of cardboard were going into the container line, they would grab them while they're breaking bags and things like that. If they see a really bad contaminant, like a car part, those often come in, they're gonna grab that, and then they're doing quality control at the end. In addition to that, there'd be loader operators, supervisors, maintenance people. But as far as working the line, they envision 3 to 4 positions.
Compared to?
12.
I would say currently, but you know what I mean.
A dozen? Yeah.
There's about 15.
15 now.
Now, but that includes the supervisors and the equipment operators and stuff like that.
Okay, so we would see a significant reduction in manpower required for this, is that correct?
Well, people actually on the line, I'm not sure. Tom, do you know how many people on the line?
Currently?
Yeah.
We ran 12 full-time and 2 part-time.
Okay, so it would be,
so
it would be
about a
60-65%
reduction, okay.
Right.
Thank you.
And much safer for those workers.
Okay. Well, you mentioned QC, which quality control.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Okay. Do you want to discuss transfer option now?
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
The biggest change since our last update, the last time we were here together, actually isn't the tornado. It's the opportunity to transfer materials to Jefferson City. Early in the previous project, we had set aside the option at direction of you all and the staff, we'd set aside as an option that RRT evaluated of transferring because there was not an option any closer than St. Louis at that time. and that is prohibitively far to transfer unprocessed recyclables from an economic standpoint, but also from a climate action standpoint, which was a key driver of this project. So we did analysis at that time of what that would look like, and then it was decided to set that aside. In the interim, recently, there has become an opportunity to transfer Columbia's collected recyclables to Jefferson City, either to be processed in a MRF there, or to be transferred from a recycling transfer station there, so it would be transferred from you, go to Jefferson City, transferred then to St. Louis. As it's been explained to me briefly, there are very different economics in each, and I don't have the data, so I can't speak to that, or I just haven't seen it. It is an analysis we can perform, but we have not, so I can't speak to that. But as far as an efficiency, expediency, and climate action, it is a whole new option. And of course, all the capital expenditures are very small compared to building a new MRF. So I was asked to discuss this a little bit with you and compare it to building your own MRF. What I haven't ranked are sort of intangible values of having an asset versus having a contract, and self-rule, self-determination of knowing I know what happens to this material rather than sending it away and trusting. These are things I did not include in the ranking because I didn't have a very clear way to make them numerical. But I understand that they are being considered in this decision-making process, and I wanted to just acknowledge that, that we're aware of it. This is an update to tables that were in the report. I've added transfer, and because they are, the ranking is against each other. The lower table ranking, that's versus one another. The upper table scoring is more relative to each other. So that's why a few of them got downgraded, because also some of their benefits were lost. As we discussed earlier in the presentation, one of the benefits of being at the LOC site was that you got to preserve the MRF building or vice versa. And so they've just been adjusted. The upper table is scoring on a sort of good-bad scale for each of the conditions that you see there: benefits, risks, limitations, time frame, and capital costs. And you can see that, for example, scenario A went up because now we have to build more building than we originally thought. And some of the others went down because we don't have to do as many changes. And then you've got transfer, which has the lowest capital cost, so it has the best score. The lower table is ranking them against one another. There are sometimes ties, because in a particular element, they're pretty close together in our estimation. So scenario B and transfer both have a lot of benefits. Not necessarily the same benefits, but they're of a magnitude that's comparable.
I guess I have a question, because on your previous slide you said that you hadn't looked into the financials of the transfer, and since that's not a column here, I guess I don't really feel as confident in the scoring and ranking, because I think those are big factors.
Are you talking about operations?
I don't know. You said that you don't have the financial analysis, obviously, because we had given the direction not to look into the transfer, but then now it's an option, but we don't know the finding. You know what I mean? I guess. I don't feel like it's all the information.
So maybe. Well, I'll say first, I don't have operations in here at all, like a per ton or per hour kind of operations cost. I can go through the columns and explain to you how that score was given to transfer, if you like.
That might be helpful, because I think for me, you know, one of the questions I have is like around the risks. And you mentioned we haven't looked into like what does the contract look like and like how long would it be. So a risk to me would be, they stop the contract and all of a sudden we're stuck without a place to take recycling again. So yeah, I would love that.
So the benefits of transfer are it can start sooner. As far as an undertaking, that's a great clarification point. I'm talking about building this and making it happen. So the benefits are it can be done more quickly, it can be done more cheaply, it can be done more readily. I'm not talking about what's it like on a day-to-day basis to have a transfer station as opposed to having a MRF. Does that clear a little? Okay. Transfer station scores.
Okay, well, then I have a question, because then on scenario B, wasn't scenario B the one where we have to build a new landfill operation center before we can build a material recovery facility?
Yes.
So wouldn't that affect, like, construction time frame and the benefit? You know what I mean? Wouldn't that make it not score as well? I mean, maybe I'm reading this wrong. Ranking the lower one, lower value is better, so I would think a one is good. So scenario B, benefit, is number one, I guess, and the construction time frame is number one, but we just talked about how it wouldn't happen for a long time until the landfill operations center is built, am I right?
Are you referring to scoring or ranking?
I'm kind of confused by the two, but yeah. I guess because in the scoring, they have the same numbers. They're all, like, construction time frame, they're all four, or else five. And so that, to me, it's scoring well and on the ranking, but we just heard that scenario B would not be built until the landfill operations center is built, which we don't have the funding for yet.
And that delays the construction.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I'm sorry, I got you off track on the transfer discussion.
I don't think that slides work much.
Yeah.
We should just move on.
Good point.
Okay.
Needing to entirely construct a new landfill operations center is new information for me.
Okay, that's fine, thank you.
And I would be happy to revise this and communicate it to you more clearly, maybe than doing it on the fly here.
That's fine.
Okay,
yeah.
We can totally do that with more narrative and explanation. And also trying to make slides more clear, but I definitely can revisit this and make sure it addresses your questions.
Thank you.
I'm trying to check my time. Where are we? 45 minutes. Okay. So knowing that we're going to revisit this with some more narrative and communicate it to you in a letter about that. Yeah,
that works. And I will just say for council, if there are any like kind of follow-up questions to this, we can email that to staff so that Erin can provide it in case there's any other questions on it.
Okay. Absolutely. In the interest of time, I want to make sure that we get to talk about the multi-material environmental center, so I'll go on ahead.
Yeah, feel free. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nope. All righty. excuse me. So the idea of having this kind of drop-off center, it's sort of the one-stop shop concept. There are a lot of different kinds of materials that people in Columbia can recycle. We've talked about a lot of them here. There's also, they can divert household hazardous waste, such as chemicals, insecticides, pesticides, and paint. That household hazardous waste operation is currently a tenant operation and with another agency, with Public Works. So being able to have, and again, it's at its own place and we can't really add recycling to that site, but we could move household hazardous waste to a new facility where everything is in one place, and then when people start to accumulate material, they can bring it all to one spot that they are familiar with, that they know where it is, it's there all the time. And this is, frankly, this is really popular approach for a lot of people in other cities. It can be staffed when we've got one major kind of facility as opposed to a scattered network. Also, the designs I'm going to show you can be really flexible. They can be a lot more flexible than a tiny paved area with brick around it. They can accommodate different materials as things change. You've got even more opportunity to add things that may come up, sort of like you both were asking about. One common material that sometimes can be collected at these kind of facilities is what's called mixed bulky plastics or mixed bulky rigids. And a 5-gallon bucket is a really good example. That plastic is actually highly recyclable. but it's very difficult to collect. You think about if you put that in your cart or at the curb or something and it's commingled with all those other small size, it doesn't work very well. But if you can get a bale of them, it does well. So that's an example of something that we could collect at that kind of facility as far as things changing and giving people more opportunity. We talk about mattresses in the report, but that's another example is if an opportunity arises, you could collect mattresses there. You could just start doing it. And then, like I said, being able to add a permanent household hazardous waste facility there. It could also, the designs we're going to look at are much safer than some of the designs that have been used previously. Yes?
Hard to recycle or reusables. I know recently that we've basically been told no glass. Mm-hmm. So is that still under the non-recyclable, hard to recycle, and that, and you know, in your audit description of equipment, glass wasn't mentioned.
Right.
So what's the status of glass?
My understanding is that residents are being instructed to leave it out right now. It's a really great question about glass, though, and this actually dovetails really well with this idea. Glass, when it's collected cleanly, is very recyclable. In the course of doing the research for the report, we talked to some recyclers of glass in Kansas City, and they said that they would come, quote-unquote, all day long to get good, clean, broken glass in a container by itself. A MRF, where glass containers are collected along with bottles and cans and paper and all that, does not produce good, clean, broken glass. It produces junky, dirty glass that's of almost no value for anything. However, if you had a big facility like this and it was staffed, you could collect glass as its own stream. Often people are skeptical that residents would do that, but they do. And all that glass gets recycled. It's a very good commodity to sell. You can even sometimes get something for it per ton, but then it costs a lot to truck it there, but it's still actually getting recycled into something new as glass cullet. And people participate very well, and the quality is very good. So this would be that would be a great example of something that you could do at this facility also. Where I live, we have that, and it has taken off so gangbusters that there is more material than what they initially intended to use it for. Like, there's more supply than there was demand when they started it. That's how much people participated in producing good material. So this would be an excellent opportunity to continue recycling glass if when it's not being collected, commingled anymore.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess a quick question for staff then. We used to have one of the purple containers at the State Farm Recycling Center. Was it a contamination issue, or how is it the use of that one for glass only?
That was the concern, and why we pulled it at this time was we were concerned it would just get contaminated with people frustrated that we weren't taking recycling, that they would just dump everything in the glass.
Okay.
It can be revisited.
Before, what was that, quote, clean collected, or did it have?
It didn't really have a market.
Yeah, I think it still had some contamination issues. So that's why a staffed facility would be better.
Yeah.
Right, so. The next slide, this is a reprint from the report, and I realize that it's kind of hard to see, but it does itemize some of the descriptors for the headlines here, which is you can change and flex this facility as needed depending on what's coming in, or even for a temporary urgent situation, for example, disaster debris collection, you could, if you were like, we're not going to be able to do recyclables at this place right now because we're taking flood debris or whatever you might need to do in an emergency, then it's much safer. The traffic flows, instead of kind of like at the old style of drop-off center, everybody comes in and they kind of go where they need to go and it's not governed by traffic control. This would be not having to lift above your head to put something into a container. Being able to access it more directly is superior accessibility and safety. And this kind of design is operational best practice. We've seen it be very successful in other locations and very popular with users also. Easy, safe, clean. It's even easier to keep clean because staff can just sweep it clean and into the containers instead of trying to pick up something that's on the ground. So it's easy to keep nice and pleasant experience, which goes a long way. I would like to show you briefly three real-world designs. I have been to in person, all three of them, so I can attest to them in addition to this. This is an overhead drawing excuse me, of a facility to be built in Olmsted County, Minnesota, which is south of the Twin Cities. They have had a facility kind of like this for a long time. This is a replacement for it. This is a little more complex than yours would be because this also takes garbage. This building is on the same campus as their waste-to-energy plant where they combust waste. So it's sort of a real all-one shop for self-haulers. But some of the good parts about this building design is cars enter, and they go up a slight incline into this building. This is under roof and has ventilation. And they enter here, and you have all these parking spots. These are, like I said, mostly for waste. So yours would be a little bit different because people would need to know, be directed by staff to go to a particular spot based on what they have. You would, for example, maybe you'd have all, one side is all the recyclables, and then another side is other special things as needed. Then you go along here, like I said, this is all undercover, and then down another slight incline back to ground level to exit. I'd ask you just try to disregard these trucks because there's a lot of them because there's a lot else going on with this building. But this design is really great for extreme weather, which I think we have here in winter and summer. It keeps it undercover, keeps all the material undercover, so it's also not subject to the weather. And people, I'll show you in a photo in a minute what it looks like when people use the, what the viewpoint is of the user. This is Tampa, Florida. I took this photo. So this is what someone sees from ground level when they're accessing the containers. You can kind of see right here that below, this drops off like a loading dock. And right here is a container in place waiting for material to go into it. Again, you've got the Z-wall design and the cars that park there to access what they're doing. This facility is all recycling, all single stream recycling. And this is on the side of their transfer station. But again, cars come along here, they go up an incline, they talk to an attendant here who directs them where to go based on what's full, what's empty, what's available, not to crowd other people who are using the facility. And then they exit here by going back down incline and leaving. This one-sided design, I think a two-sided would probably be better for Columbia because you're thinking about collecting a variety of materials to have more maneuvering space, but this one does show a more compact footprint, and I wanted to share this photo also so you can see what it looks like when you're there.
Kate, can I ask, Tampa's obviously a very large city, so do they have multiple of these or just the one?
They have just this one. They used to have a lot of those corner of the parking lot drop-off centers, and they're all closed now due to dirtiness and dumping. So that was part of why they built this one. This is, like I said, this is just for recycling. This facility, the building that, if you're taking this photo, it's at my back, is, they call it their transfer station, but it's really a lot more like the hand unloading center that a lot of places have where someone brings their own little trailer with stuff from their house, or a small business person, when they finish work, they come at the end of the day and they're hand unloading as opposed to a garbage truck, which automatically unloads. So this is a citizen facility of more than one type of material. So someone could come here, do the recycling, and then also get rid of their palm fronds in Tampa, palm fronds and broken furniture and things like that. So it's part of a larger service center. Okay. And then the last one, just to show another option, This was, and this was in your report also, this is a long-time facility in Charlottesville, Virginia, where the University of Virginia is located. This is right in a neighborhood, as you can see from the aerial, people live across the street. It's about a half an acre, not including the driveway. It's staffed during daylight hours with 1.5 FTEs. And they just have their little shed there, which is air conditioned, and then they have the roll-off compactors here. And people come in and they park along here, and then they walk up and they put stuff into the container that they need to use. Going by memory, I think, for example, one of these is straight cardboard to keep that nice material separate. Also, way down there, they take oyster shells that are recycled into different products. But they also were able to, having a flexible facility like this, they were able to pilot some different materials to see would people participate, like buckets and things like that, and see how it would do, because it's nice and flexible, everything is modular. But this is an example of you could get going pretty quickly on this type of operation before even building anything substantial. And they're not in the photo, but there's sanitary facilities here too, obviously. We have on the next slide some very high-level scheduling, and as we all know and we'll look at here, some of the major changes to the possible scheduling from the last iteration of the report is the potential for emergency procurement. I have not been able yet to become conversant in that in Columbia or the state of Missouri, so I don't have a lot of comment on it, but it is something to be considered if our timeline originally included long windows of time based on our experience for procurement of equipment, procurement of building, procurement of engineering services. If there is, if there are provisions to help advance that timeline, then that's probably one of the biggest developments since the storm. Our last report said 30 months. We would estimate that maybe about a year or ish, maybe less, could be shaved off depending on different procurement. That's based on experience in other states. For example, we had allowed 6 months for procurement of MRF equipment through an RFP process. And then once we get the RFPs in, then we go back and forth. When we do this work, we go back and forth with them. Well, this isn't really what we wanted, that's too expensive, you missed this. And so it's a much more complex procurement than some others might be, or straight services. There's also an unknown timing element of if you need a permit, could it be expedited by DNR because this is an emergency. Transfer station can be started very quickly. Operationally, all you really have to do is dump the trucks out, pick it back up with a loader, and put it in the top of a transfer trailer and take it where it needs to go. That's not a sustainable operation, but that's essentially what it is, and that there are facilities operating like that all over the country. If that was going to be your permanent solution, you'd want to build something that's more cost-effective and sustainable and resilient. When we talked to some builders, they did suggest that whatever you might decide to do, you could get going even a little sooner with a canvas building to start. Maybe during the current building season, and then look at something more permanent in the next building season. Not trying to build something in the middle of winter.
Nick, you
know. So, yeah, that was a question I had about a fabric building. That would really be a temporary thing. You'd build over it?
Yes.
Around it?
Litter. You really need to contain blowing litter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can't really do this in the open air.
Right.
And a fabric building is the fastest way to get something up that will work. And so you could get that up promptly, and then look at not only the more time to build a metal building, but to procure it in a more paced way, and look at what you really want to do, how many people are really going to be working here, so that we have the structure for them, putting in sanitation and things like that.
Don, you had one.
Yeah, operating costs for transfer station, I'm guessing it's going to be more than just a simple expense of the trucking. Is that correct? I mean, is there, would Jefferson City charge us a fee to take our stuff? Any, and maybe that's a little too far down in the weeds for tonight, but you know, is that, but that's something that normal process or normal
or did you?
Operations.
I'll defer to staff on the costs that have been researched thus far per ton. If you're talking about the operations inside the transfer station, it's going to be much less than MRF processing.
No, I understand
but
that.
But if you're talking about after that, I'll
yeah,
defer
I mean, staff. Yes, we'll have our expenses there, mm-hmm. but then I'm guessing Jefferson City isn't saying just don't bring it on down.
Right. Yeah, that's we're still investigating that.
Okay.
Can I ask what? I mean, it's not Jefferson City's not doing the recycling. So what is the name of the company that's doing it?
There's two in Jefferson City. There's Republic and Federal.
Okay, so those are the two you're talking to see what we can do.
Which is the one that, because I think one of my other thoughts I heard earlier when you talked about it, it sounds like the one is also just a transfer station. So it's still going to St. Louis. So it's just that it's off our consciousness because we're not paying that part. You know what I mean? So I feel
right.
That still consideration is that it's still going to St. Louis rather than being sorted locally. We could theoretically know where the material's ending up.
So,
I don't know which is which, though, the Republic or
yeah.
Republic hauls theirs to either Springfield or St. Louis.
Okay.
Federal hauls, if I remember, there were pieces of theirs that they could haul to another facility, but there was some that they sorted on site. Is that right? Do you remember that?
I think you got that right.
Yeah.
So you're talking to them to get more information about what it would cost us to transfer it down there or what they would pay for it if we sent it there and then the cost for us shipping it? What?
Yes and yes. I mean, they may charge us to take it.
Uh-huh.
Or some of them may provide a rebate and, share the cost of selling those commodities.
Okay. Do you have a feel for how long it would take to get more specific information?
We have a meeting, I believe, later this week with Mid-Missouri Solid Waste District that she set up.
Okay.
To discuss with.
So maybe in the next 2 to 4 weeks?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Before you move, are you about to move on, Kate?
The next one says thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, don't get there yet. No, okay. On the convenience center, has staff thought about a location? Would it be at the landfill, or would it be some? You know, I'm trying to think of. We saw three very different kind of locations of examples of other communities, and just wondering if you've given thought to that.
I've personally, had some ideas. Tom's personally had some ideas, but we haven't discussed, specifically with staff what those ideas are, or where those locations might be.
Okay.
Do we have an idea how much space you need? Like, is it like a 2-acre site or a 4-acre site, or it can be however big we want to make it? Or?
It can be however big you want to make it. We recently did some sketches for another option for Tampa to make more like that, and I had one that was 1 acre, and I have one that's 5 acres and is part of like a dog park and all other kinds of things.
Well, I think to that point, I was interested in if you have knowledge of any of them having experience with having any of those like community partners or other organizations. Like the TerraCycle or whoever it is that does the Tetra Pak recycling, that if they had a dumpster or if Ripple Glass had a dumpster, are any of the multi-material convenience centers that you've seen, do they have any of those, like this isn't done by the city, this is another entity, but they partner?
I know that Ripple sometimes will put their own container and they pull it as needed. I know of at least two places where they do that. That's kind of what they alluded to when I talked to them almost 2 years ago. Because they want their container and they kind of are in charge of it and they keep an idea of it. Tetra Pak, They were doing grants for a while where they were helping retrofit a MRF line to capture them, but I don't think they're doing that any longer. It was the Carton Council was actually doing that, but it was a lot of, it was for Tetra Pak. Other materials, I mean, sometimes, not that center I showed you in Charlottesville, but outside of town where they do have their big trash, like where trash trucks go, and they have some bins that they work with some local well-known charities where they do reuse. So they get a lot of aluminum boats, and this service organization does the boats, and if they're scrapped, then they scrap them as aluminum, or they can maybe repair them. Bicycles, that actually, now that I'm thinking about it, bicycles is a good example where you collect a whole bunch of bicycles, and then there's a nonprofit that repairs them, and then they are used as part of micro businesses in other parts of the world, because if you have a bicycle, you can have a business delivering things or selling your product or getting to market. So bicycles is probably a really excellent example.
Thank you.
That's the end of my prepared slides, and I know Erin has some content to present too. So I think the big action item I had was to think and write some more for you about the ranking and scoring. And I think I'll check with Tom and Erin, but maybe a letter is the best way to communicate that, just to expand on that, and we can collaborate on that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back. Thank you.
So thanks, Kate.
She was talking about the MRF, and then, you know, the next thing that comes up is thinking about costs and how we're going to pay for it. And so there's just a few other things I wanted to run through. Just so you can think of all these things as we ask you for direction on how to move forward.
Good point.
So just a quick update on the MRF, because I assure you want to know. Our demolition contractor, they're substantially complete with the demolition. We had an electrical contractor out there today to help us figure out how to power some of the existing equipment. So we've got a baler and underground conveyor. And if we can get those operational, then we can start doing some recycling again. We would need to consider, you know, the fabric roof or you know, long term. And so that's one of the discussion points is, you know, how quickly do we need to be up and running with something now? And then how does that tie into our long term permanent solutions, you know, so for example, putting up a fabric roof, that would be considered a stranded cost because you're going to put up the fabric roof, but then for the permanent solution, you're going to take that down and dispose of it. You know, you're not going to be able to reuse it, you know, use it as part of the permanent solution. So that's an additional cost per se that you wouldn't have if you were just putting up a permanent structure. So there's, you know, like everything, there's costs and benefits, right, to how quickly you move forward.
If we did, you say a fabric roof, I assume you mean a fabric building, similar to what Kate was describing as possible. We couldn't use the same building for the same purpose.
I mean, well, you could use the building, but you would need a whole new roof, right? You'd have to build another building over it.
We'd need to do that anyway, though, right?
Right, you need to do the permanent building, but what I'm saying is that fabric part then goes away, right?
Right.
So that's an expense that you've done on a temporary basis.
Right.
So how many of those temporary expenses are you?
I guess what I'm confused about is would we need one or two? Because would we need to do this to do something in the interim and then do a different fabric building for what the MRF does? I mean, if it's in the same location.
Right, yeah, those are all the questions that we're dealing with.
Okay.
And that's what I'm trying to make an example that
okay.
There's, you know, you do it this way and then you've got all these extra costs, or if you wait longer and work on the permanent solution, you don't have all those extra costs, but then you're not doing your own
recycling.
Right.
So, you know, those are the pros and cons that to think about.
Okay, keep going. I'm sure there's more.
Right, yes, there's more. We are working with insurance. Just know it's a 20-year-old building with 20, you know, equipment that's more than 20 years old. And so we receive the value of that equipment and the building as it is, not as what it would cost us to build a new building. So I've heard in the range of $3 to $4 million. There's still a lot of work to be done to finalize that number and some of the other insurance settlement numbers that's for the building. So that doesn't include the equipment right now, because a lot of it will depend on if that equipment's operational. So that's just rough numbers. And then as far as this process, we are planning to do kind of a community survey at the block parties on Be Heard and other our other outreach efforts to just try to get with the community to try to prioritize what's important about recycling and what items are important to recycle and, you know, how quickly, what's it worth? You know, what costs are they willing to afford for our community to continue to do recycling? So in the last months, I've gained an appreciation for how important recycling is. It's obviously in our CAP plan. Those are our three major goals. There's some other goals underneath that. But like this weekend, I heard a story about somebody said his mother was taking the recycling to St. Louis so it could be recycled. You know, obviously people are taking it to Jeff City and Ashland. We've heard those stories. So it's important, but there is a financial cost. So I just want to be sure we're on the same page about that. So when we talk about costs for replacing the MRF, we have other expected expenses in the next 5 years that have not been accounted for in any revenue increases. Those include compensation increases, both past and hopefully future, inflation costs, the new MRF we've talked about, automated recycling, and then horizontal expansion of the landfill. Now that one we are accounting for in our budget. We expect that to be about $12 million. We've already put away $6 million in the capital improvement plan, so that's restricted cash, and we have a plan for that. But these are all things I just want to be sure that you're considering as we look to finance these things. And just to be clear, our recycling is important. It's an important societal benefit. But I want you to understand that our operation does not make money. As you can see, the recycling, and this is an 18-month period. This is from October of 2023 to March of this year. We provided this to our insurance company. So it's 18 months, so it's not a year. So I know that's kind of weird. But finance provided it to us, and it was available to me, so I thought I'd share it. The recycling sold in that 18-month period was about $1.6 million worth. The fees that we collect from the commercial customers was about $1 million. What it costs us to operate that operation is about $6 million. So it is a loss. You know, you figure depreciation in there, which is a magic number to me. I'll let Matthew explain that, but you know, it's still, we're operating at more than $3 million loss. So, okay. Just so we're all on the same page, I would just want to.
Can I ask, did you have a chance to look back? Because I'm trying, when did we start doing the curbside recycling again? Isn't that?
Yeah.
So I, you know what I mean? So I
right.
was just wondering.
Yeah, so there was a period of time we weren't picking up the curbside recycling,
yeah.
But it was going to the drop-off sites and things like that. So, and there are probably other years where maybe we made a little bit more or made a little bit
markets,
less.
Right.
Yeah, it
right.
all depends on the market.
Right.
I would say it's probably,
both.
Well, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to make an assumption and be wrong. So this is the forecast that finance provided to y'all last month, or not in the recent past. And again, we have been putting money away for the landfill expansion. But this forecast doesn't include any of those other items, really.
doesn't include
it. It doesn't include a new MRF. It doesn't include compensation increases.
What about the landfill?
It does include the landfill expansion. We are putting money away in there. You can see the $3.5 million and the $3.75 million. That's to try to get up in the next year's CIP line. That's for the landfill expansion. And you can see that we have a lot of cash above target right now, so a lot of excess cash reserves. But as you keep adding expenses, then that goes away. And in 2031, you can see that we're starting to spend more than we're making. And so as we add on some of these other items that I listed before, our cash reserves are going to go down even before 2031. So we will need to consider some revenue increases to.
This assumes revenue remains the same and that rates remain the same to the.
This assumes rates remain the same.
Erin, can I ask, and I can't remember, when we first started the discussion around the MRF in 23, you weren't with Solid Waste at the time, actually, I don't know, anyway. But I mean, when we started that conversation, I assumed that we would be thinking we were going to have some expenses related to it, but was the plan that we would just wait until we got back what the potential was, and then we'd figure out
financing? Okay. So there will need to be some sort of bond financing. One of the things the state has reached out to us on some funding mechanisms they have for the landfill cell. So we were going to try to pay for the landfill using cash because, you know, the last one we funded with bonds, well, the landfill cell only lasts 10 years, but then you're bonding it, you know, more than 20 years, which financially doesn't really make sense to bond for something that doesn't last as long as you're paying for it. So that's why we were going to try to pay cash for the next landfill expansion. But if we can get some special financing through the state, then maybe we, you know, do some bond funding there and do the MRF more cash.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and call our Monday, June 2nd pre-council to order. As a reminder, to make the audio better, we are using microphones, so we'll share. And we have one topic on tonight's agenda, and it is the material recovery facilities discussion. So I'm going to kick it over to Almost official director, Erin Keats.
Good evening. Erin Keats, Utilities Director. Tonight we're talking about options for the solid waste material recovery facility and recycling and some solid waste topics. So we have Kate Vasquez here from RRT to give a presentation on their report on the additional analysis for MRF options. And just following that, I was going to discuss some other solid waste and MRF topics, update on the MRF, the community desire for our recycling program, our some solid waste finances, a proposal for automated recycling collection, and then seeking some council direction. So just keep that in mind. So I think Kate's presentation is a different one, so we'll get that.
There's me.
There we go. And I'll turn it over to Kate.
All right. Well, thank you, Erin. Thanks, everyone. It's really great to be back here in Columbia to talk with you guys again, to give an update on some of the analysis regarding recycling processing here in Columbia, both continuing the work of the project that was ongoing and then also in the wake of the storm from April 20th. I just wanted to give you a quick layout of the contents of the slides. We're going to look at just a reminder of what the project has done in the past few years that we've been working on it, what we know of the current program status as it has changed since the report was written. We'll revisit the three options for rebuilding in MRF as they were generated before the storm and as what has changed with the voluntary demolition of the existing MRF. And we will revisit the discussion of a transfer option and then look briefly at the concept of a new kind of drop-off center. We're using multimedia, multi-material environmental center right now.
because it would not only be recycling drop-off in this concept, it would be some other materials, so we'll talk about that. And then we have some revised, very high-level timelines to talk about, but there are some drivers that are unknowable right now, but they are expected to affect the timeline as it was originally projected. So briefly, I'm not going to read all this to you, but basically when we last met, there were three urgent issues that are now resolved or they're moot discussions. At that time, curbside recycling had been suspended. It would go in and out for staffing reasons that we all understand. The recycling drop-off centers were considered in real dire shape. They were contributing greatly to contamination at the recycling center at the MRF, and they were diverting a lot of staff time to handle that dumping situation where things that then people couldn't cram into the recycling containers, they would. And then the third was our concerns with the MRF itself. It was not operating as designed, so it was operating inefficiently. And then it had a lot of other issues that we're all familiar with from the previous reports that are moot now because it's, you know, it's out of operation. Now we are facing the need to restart processing of the collected recyclables, the need to reopen a drop-off facility to be determined, and the need to renew and improve programs as discussed throughout this project. The current status that we're looking at, previously our project had found that there was a lot of interest and participation was pretty good at Columbia. There could be more volume, but people who were participating were doing a good job as far as avoiding contamination. And the set out rate, which is a little different than participation, but what I observed at the curb was slightly low, but not bad. So it was good, and what people were putting was good. So I would take that as a good, strong interest in recycling. I think that's what that reflects. There was a lot of trouble at the drop-off centers, as I said, and we had identified as a high priority cardboard that was coming out of the business sector and being disposed of as trash instead of recycled as a commodity. And the biggest opportunities we were looking at were improving programs, including participation and quality, in order to increase diversion and recycling. In our current conditions, from what I have observed from a distance, there is still a lot of active interest in recycling in Columbia. That's also what I hear from staff. The drop-off centers are at this moment closed. We all know that. And we have a priority of getting processing of recyclables back and some drop-off, quality drop-off for people when they have excess material or they have something, they have a lot of equipment or they miss their set out date, something like that. We still have a big opportunity to reduce contamination and optimize services. So this is a graph that was from the original report. This is from the waste composition study that the city commissioned and RRT had a specialized vendor conduct. This is a very high level explanation of the material that is delivered to the landfill during the survey period. 21% of it was material that the discard person could have put into a recycling program. So this is our very typical bottles and cans and cardboard. I do want to clarify, it does not include, for example, every single piece of plastic, because every single piece of plastic can't go into a recycling program. And that would be what was over in the 41% for disposal, so like toothpaste caps and things like that. They were subject to the study. I just wanted to clarify that 21% is items that could have been put into recycling. The 38% of other recyclables are materials that an individual in existing programs in Columbia could have diverted from disposal, but they did not. Plastic grocery bags, food scraps, clothing, textiles, these are all things for which there are outlets other than the garbage can, but that didn't happen. These were identified as more opportunities to support community-based programs, not necessarily that the city would get into the business of taking textiles or organics or something like that. But they can be diverted from disposal with individual effort. This chart is also from the original report.
And this is the top 10 items that were in the waste characterization study, i.e. material that was delivered to the landfill. And a lot of these are trash, as I said. Like, you see there's remainder or composite organics, dirty paper, mixed recycled paper, things that do belong in the trash. But right here is, again, just pointing out there is a lot of cardboard being delivered to the landfill as waste, even before any of the current circumstances. And 10 to 1, it's from the business sector, not residential. So that's, I'm just underscoring the importance of not losing sight of that, because it is a big opportunity to recycle and divert more material, and cardboard is a really valuable commodity. Excuse me. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of recap for everyone the three scenarios that we continued to analyze for rebuilding MRF. This is going to tie together both the analysis from before the storm and then some commentary since. As a reminder, our first report included several other options, which we were directed to not pursue any further. One was to stop processing locally, for example, and begin transferring out of town. That was, I'll talk about that in a minute, but that was set aside early in the process. Some information has changed. But I want to look at the three for which we did conceptual designs, just to make sure everyone is familiar with them. So there were three, and they basically all involve building a new MRF at the landfill campus. Scenario A is to build on the existing site. The initial analysis included the interest in salvaging what might be possible of the building, not the equipment, but the actual structure, most of which is gone now. But that was the idea, is that it would be the same footprint. There's already concrete and pavement and other infrastructure already in place, so there would be some savings. Scenario B was to build a whole new MRF on what's currently the landfill operations site, directly across the driveway from the admin building. And then the third was to build a whole new MRF on the gravel lot that's due west of the admin building. I can show you some drawings here real briefly. This to orient you, there, this is the aerial. That's the current MRF site that you see a design on. North is up. And if Aaron, if you would, please, that's the admin building, yeah, mm-hmm. Just to orient everyone. So the idea here was to reuse a lot of the existing traffic flow and the pad that the building was on, and a lot of pavement that could be built, reused, or rebuilt, or repurposed. When we made this design, we were constrained that we couldn't have traffic go through. So I did just want to show that if the scale house was moved, the traffic could move also. Because one of our concerns with this design was we didn't love a bunch more truck traffic going in front of the admin bin building. This is a minor update, but I did want to make the point that that can now be modified.
Can you point out where the scale is on that?
So there were some plans and drawings done several years ago to relocate the scale to the site that's there near the, right there. You can't really see it very well, but it does say relocated scale location just above those red and blue arrows.
Oh, right there.
Right.
And where is
currently,
it
it's due north of that.
Currently, it's right
that's
there.
That's the scale now.
Because the future landfill is down here, so that's why they were looking at moving the scale house.
We were trying to be mindful of that.
Where is the new one?
The new one's going to be down.
Landfill cell or scale
here.
House?
The new landfill cell is going to be down here.
Is down? I'm sorry, I can't see down here where.
South of the admin.
You see where the red dot is?
Okay.
It's not on the diagram, so
okay. It's
over here.
All right,
our existing
thanks.
Landfill is up here in this upper corner.
So the advantage of changing the direction for traffic would be that you just avoid traffic past the admin building?
Right.
And that...
I'm going to ask you to use the microphone.
Microphone.
Oh. Sorry.
Complain about it not being loud enough. And
yeah.
I know.
Okay.
There's the complaints.
So the advantage of moving the traffic is primarily to avoid going past the admin building? Or are there
Correct.
Other things that are helpful there?
Correct. So having more truck traffic come through here, as you see these lines, is not desirable. And this route, we anticipated, even if the scale didn't move, this route now is congested with the new the next landfill cell. But we now know, since we did this drawing, and I didn't redo the drawing for expediency, it could go through here. We now know. That was new information since we made the drawing. So I just wanted to clarify that in the report, you'll see it say one of the drawbacks of scenario A is having to put traffic through the admin building. And that's no longer the case.
I gotcha.
I should have led with that. So that I just wanted to make that point because it's one of the major objections to scenario A in our analysis that's no longer involved. Do you guys, you want to go to the next one? So this was scenario B, I'll just keep this. This was scenario B, which is to build on the current landfill operations center site. So there's the old MRF, there's the admin building. And this design, this is also different than you saw in the first report if you looked at that, because again, we had that site constraint for this location removed. The same one that was constraining the traffic from the design we were just looking at now allows this design to be more flexible. It was really constrained before. One of the best parts about this design is it keeps, you see, all its traffic is contained to itself. It doesn't have to intersect with anything else. And it would keep all this, this is all still unencumbered if it's not a MRF anymore. And then scenario C, which we don't have a lot of optimism about, but this is land that's there. That's the gravel lot that's due west of the admin building. It used to be a compost pad. There's a lot of unknowns. And again, same thing with the new landfill cell is going to be down here. And you have to access it like this or like this. It's just not, when there's better options. So these were the scenarios that we analyzed. We presented in the first report, and then the city asked RRT to continue with more in-depth analysis of these three, including scoring and ranking them against one another. So we did that. So just to show you, this is how the table looked when it was in the report. And this reflects some of the changes. Obviously, almost everything with scenario A has changed. There's no buildings to salvage, and the issue of needing to transfer during construction is no longer an issue. Also, this site is now rivaled in size by scenario B with the site constraints loosened. So one of the pros of scenario A had been there's plenty of room, but now B has plenty of room also. A little bit about the future use benefit, which is mentioned throughout. Scenario B and Scenario C both offered the benefit of preserving the current MRF site for future use, perhaps for maintenance operations, and or redeveloping it as a drop-off center or something else. The benefit isn't exactly mutual because neither the LOC site nor the gravel lot are as flexible as the MRF site. So there's still that benefit for B and C of you've still got all that space where the old MRF was that you could do something else with in the future. It's very flexible, it's sizable. So this is just the change. Like I said, scenario A, almost everything changes. The big differences for B and C are there's not a building there anymore where the MRF used to be.
Kate, before you go on.
Yes.
Can I ask on that, so I understand it's an update from the chart that was originally put together, but this reads like there's no benefits, you know what I mean, there's no longer risk, there's no limitations. Was it that RRT didn't have, because you had already completed the reports, didn't do any of those benefit risk analysis for the reuse of the existing site?
I have on another slide the risk-benefit ranking analysis that we did, and it has been updated. If you're asking about use of the site for the future?
No, for rebuilding, for that current site, for rebuilding a new MRF.
We will. I do have information about that, yes. Many of the risks are now, they're no longer in play. One of the biggest drawbacks of scenario A was having to shut down and transfer. And now they all involve transfer,
right,
because it is shut down. So as far as comparing one to the other, that's irrelevant. Similarly, the equipment inside the building was going to cost the same no matter what the where the building was. And so that wasn't something to rank between the three options. This is kind of summarizes what I just said, but to get at it real directly, is that the rebuilding on the existing MRF site at this time is now the most expedient in a time sense, because there's very little that we need to do to get ready. There's nothing, you know, there's not much to demo. It's already been demoed. We're already shut down, and we don't have to move anything else. At the LOC site, we have to move some operations. At the gravel lot, I would imagine, we are assuming a large amount of geotechnical and site preparation. Scenario B offers the best integration with possible future capital plans related to opening the south landfill cell. And the cost estimate for scenario A is still marginally less than B and C, despite the loss of the building, partly because of all the pavement that already exists and the other infrastructure. These are the assumptions we used when doing the cost modeling. These are in the report also. There's an assumption. One is very key here, though. Our initial reading of the DNR rules is that both the transfer station and a MRF need a solid waste permit. And at this time, we know that there's a landfill permit, but some more research needs to be done about what that would involve. And that's time that we can't predict at this moment without additional working with the state and learning more about that. Other than that, most of these, they remain the same. They explain how we calculated owner's engineer fees and how costs of unnecessary demo aren't included, such as that. And finance and interest are not part of our cost estimate either. I wanted to share with you this diagram that explains what the buy is for the processing equipment. This was generously provided by an industry partner, CP, and they are one of the four major designers. This is not a recommendation or endorsement, other than we know them to be a reputable company. They just provided this design as a courtesy, as an example of something that would meet the parameters for which we were seeking pricing, and then they gave us a number to use. You can see across the upper part of the design, this is still a dual stream system. The container line is the upper part of the diagram. I'll use my clicker here. The upper part here, it flows from left to right. I'll just point out a few of the elements. This is where bags, bottles and cans still come in bags, and the bags get broken, and the film goes to a compactor. The materials come through. The film is pulled out manually. The magnet sends the ferrous materials to a silo. And the blue colored pieces of equipment sort on five different kinds of plastics, which is an improvement from the previous system. Number one, PET bottles. Number two, HDPE natural, like a milk jug. Number two, HDPE color, like a Tide bottle. And a 3-7 mix. And a number five, polypropylene, the best example, is a sour cream tub. And then the ECS, which is an eddy current separator, sends out aluminum cans. And then residue, which is everything else, goes to a trash compactor. The bunkers and silos all feed balers to go out and be marketed as commodities. The fiber line, which is the lower part of the diagram, I typed this out so I could get it all. The lower part of the diagram, this has a metering drum which sorts by size so that the burden depth is good on continuing to process the different kinds of paper. The OCC screen, OCC is the abbreviation for corrugated containers. It kicks out the cardboard or material that acts like cardboard, looks or seems like cardboard to the screen. And then that gets quality checked by a person as, yes, this is cardboard, or no, this is not cardboard, and it goes back into the system to keep being sorted. The blue equipment sorts out, I'm going to point to it. Blue equipment sorts out the residue, sorts on fiber, and also on a different kind of fiber here, the chipboard, that's more like a cereal box. And the residue bunker, if it starts looking like it's got a lot of bottles and cans in it, it can send it back over to the other line to go through that line and get sorted also.